Robbie.
And I'm Tracy.
And this is Animation Station.
Episode two. I like to say things twice for emphasis.
All right.
Like Casey Kasem.
Fair enough.
Is he still alive? He's still alive. No, he's dead. Anyway.
You're asking the wrong person.
We're getting off topic. Anyway.
Oh, dear.
Welcome back. If you're joining us again, if this is your first time, welcome anyway.
So this time we're talking about Cats Don't Dance, which, if you don't know, is a 1997 animated movie.
Mm-hmm. By Turner Feature Animation.
And it's the only movie
that they made. The general story is a, is it a rags to riches? I don't know. Not really. It's more like fish out of water, I guess, for lack of a better term.
It's kind of an underdog story in some ways.
Yeah.
The basic plot is, you're presented with Danny, who is a cat, literally a cat.
Yes.
Loves to sing and dance, and he wants to move to Hollywood and essentially be in, like, musicals and things.
Yeah, he wants to become a Hollywood actor. It's 1939, and he's headed from Kokomo, Indiana, which is a small town, basically in the middle of nowhere, Indiana, at that point, anyway. And he wants to move to Hollywood to become a famous actor, and he does so. He goes on a bus, and he has a plan for, like, about a week about, like, how he's becoming a superstar.
In fairness, I think based on the movie's timing, that does actually happen. But
yeah, like every day is like 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to gauge. But anywho, so he goes to Hollywood, and he's initially just this bright-eyed, bushy-tailed fella, and he's all like, "Oh, I got a part." Like
he's almost Jimmy Stewart, but he can like sing and dance.
He has that same positive energy. Yeah.
He goes to Hollywood. He gets an agent with a casting agency that deals exclusively with animal actors.
Yes.
Yeah. Wherein he meets his later revealed to be love interest Sawyer, who is the secretary there. They are both paired together to star in a movie for the Shirley Temple lookalike character named Darla Dimple.
Right.
Who's
our antagonist?
Yeah, she is our antagonist. She is referred to as as America's sweetheart, lover of children and animals, but she is not quite that.
No, she is not
quite. We'll go through that a little bit later, but I guess we'll cross that bridge in a minute.
Yeah, yeah. So. Well, so he gets a part to be in this movie that's a weird biblical adaptation of...
It's basically Noah's Ark, but with an angel, where it's like, Noah's nowhere to be found.
No, it's just some tiny angel takes it upon herself to build an ark and save the animals.
Yeah, Noah never happened, apparently.
Yeah.
And Noah is not canon in this story.
Yeah, that's an interesting fan interpretation.
Yeah, taking some liberties. Anyway,
yeah,
we're not getting into that.
On the first day on set, he's like, "What? I only have one line. It's ridiculous." And he starts singing and dancing on set, and they're like Darla freaks out.
You don't really improvise at that point in the 30s. It's everything's kind of by the book, especially with Darla. She's got a tyrannical, pretty much psychotic stronghold over these productions. So if anything goes out of line that she doesn't care for, she'll call in her manservant, Max, who's a gigantic stoic gorilla, this gigantic fridge of a man. Fridge of a gorilla.
he's like eight fridges. He's really big.
He's built like a story tall dresser, I would say.
Yeah, that's a pretty accurate description.
But Max is hilarious. But no, he comes in, he's her muscle, and he will screw up anybody that tries to mess with Darla. Or so much as talks back to her, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's definitely, he's both the muscle and, weirdly, like, the butler and everything.
Yeah, he's,
like,
he's kind of a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
But, Danny is kind of traumatized after that day, but he doesn't let it get him down. He keeps assuming that it was something that he had done, as though, like, he had just had a bad performance, and like, no, it's just because you tried to interfere with Darla being a control freak.
Right, exactly. So... then he meets, Woolly Mammoth, who is, he's like the, studio mascot.
Yeah, he's,
the MGM.
Yeah, the MGM lion. Yeah, Leo the Lion was the name of the, this lion that would, roar at the beginning of all the MGM movies back in the golden age of Hollywood. So that's all that Woolley does, he came there to hopefully become a scorer for movies,
yeah,
and that he would do soundtracks. But yeah, they were just like, yeah, all we want you for is just to trumpet at the start of every single movie, and he's really bummed out.
Yeah, yeah. So he meets Woolley, who's kind of like a mentor character for him,
mm-hmm.
and then Woolley kind of tells him about, like, oh, you know, we all started out the same, like, energetic level as you, and then we were here for about a week.
and then the system crushed us all terribly.
And ground us all to dust.
Remember our dreams? We don't either. That's why we all work in these menial jobs that we hate.
Yeah, exactly. So,
oh, man.
They're
on the nose for a couple of things.
It's a little rough. So.
But no, Woolley recounts to Danny his relationships with these other side characters that we meet that include Tilly the Hippo, Cranston the Goat, TW the Turtle, Francis the Fish, and Sawyer, as we mentioned before, where they all came to Hollywood for different roles, I think. Sawyer wanted to be a dancer, actress.
Yeah, but, she definitely sung dance.
Yeah, like, probably like jazz or something is what she came here for.
Absolutely.
TW wanted to be an action star. Francis and Cranston were, I think, like some kind of like couple or something.
Yeah, they're kind of weirdly some like...
Yeah, almost like a Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire thing where they were dance partners, they were in romantic comedies. I think that's what they were
I think that's kind of what they were going for, because there's numerous references in the movie to them like dancing together.
But systematically, they just can't seem to find any work, so...
Right. So then Danny has this whole, like, there's this whole scene, which is super fun, where they're all, he just kind of starts an impromptu, like,
a random
dance party
random
in an
dance
alley.
Party for no reason.
Just put, like, in an alley.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird.
He finds, like, a big pile of clothes, and is just like, whatever, guys, let's just have a, what would now be considered, what are they, flash mobs?
they just do
an impromptu flash mob.
With live music.
Yeah, I mean, it was for no organization whatsoever. Everybody picked on it almost immediately.
Yeah, no, they picked up pretty quick.
But yeah, so Darla overhears them as to Sawyer. Sawyer comes down to join Danny. They have a really nice little duet dance together.
Yeah.
They all get upset, or, well, they all just kind of start reflecting. It's like, oh, it would never happen. Like, there's no work for animals. It's just for people.
Right.
So Danny has an idea, like, hey, why don't I try talking to LB Mammoth, who's the head of the Mammoth Studios that they all work for, to see if he would consider giving them bigger parts so that they can try to get to the glory that they want.
Right, exactly.
Darla, overhearing this, decides to concoct a plan to have Danny come over for tea so that she can manipulate him into trusting her. and then he comes over and she gives him something of the plan that what she was thinking of, I guess, but she manipulates him into making it seem as though it's a good idea, and then she completely backstabs him.
Right, yeah, oh, absolutely.
she doesn't have friends for a reason.
Yeah,
but,
they plan this big big song and dance number
for LB to showcase their talents for them. Yeah,
and so
Darla gives them control of the stage, the arc, like all the sets and everything, all the costumes, what have you.
Right, exactly. And then while he's doing a press conference outside, and from Danny's viewpoint, they're gonna open up and do the whole song and dance. And Darla just sabotages the whole thing by having Max create a storm, which...
Yeah, they flood the stage.
Floods the studio!
The most elaborate contained hurricane I've ever seen.
That then, like, washes out and, like, floods the entire, like, studio
the entire lot, which is enormous, apparently.
Yeah.
Where they're also they're filming another biblical epic Samson or Hercules?
No, that's Samson. Hercules isn't biblical, so yeah.
It's kind of counts. There are Greek columns everywhere. Anyway, I'm sorry. The entire lot gets flooded, and all the animals get blamed, and they get kicked off the set.
Yeah, kicked off the lot.
And I think they're basically banished from ever working for the studio.
Yeah, it's kind of...
Which just
kinda,
ruined all of their careers.
Yeah, you kind of get the sense that they're blacklisted
mm-hmm.
at that point.
Well, as there's no other proof otherwise to showcase that they didn't do it, it's, you know, it gets pinned, the blame gets pinned on them.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Darla comes back out to gloat after she tied up poor Pudge the Penguin, who we really love. Robbie and I both really enjoy Pudge the Penguin because he's so darn cute.
Cute, well, he's a plucky little penguin.
He was just wearing a little hat all the time, but yeah, no, like, so she gloats in front of all the animals and cackles away as Max drives her off into the sunset.
Right.
And Danny feels betrayed and everyone doesn't trust him anymore.
Yeah.
And he feels like a pariah, so he just decides to leave town.
Right, so he starts heading back to...
it was like only 3 days later. It's like,
yeah, it was Danny. Not a long time.
It's not the best introduction to LA for
not,
the...
Not ideal.
It's not ideal. Sawyer and the rest of the other side characters... all collected a diner to sort of lick their wounds and just have a pity party and blame
Danny
when he's not there. And then Sawyer has a nice little song.
Yeah, she has like a little song by herself.
Yeah.
Which, and also kind of like a weird flashback montage.
Yeah, which is weird considering that since the movie is only about 75 minutes long.
Wait, the flashback is about 10 minutes previous.
Yeah, it was weird because we just got a clip. The flashbacks are basically just like a clip show of the song and dance number that they had in the
slow
studio.
Motion,
in
though.
Slow motion,
so,
yeah.
It was very strange.
It was a little weird, but it was still cute. Like,
yeah,
the song was nice,
I mean,
too.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said for the fact that, like, Danny has that moment. And Danny clearly is, like, can't be more than 20.
What,
equivalent age.
Oh, like his age. Yeah, probably.
Like, he's a kid.
Yeah, he's clearly a youngin.
Yeah, so.
Even though he's voiced by a very hot Scott Bakula.
Yeah, who would have been.
This was prime just after Quantum Leap Scott Bakula.
Yeah,
one of my favorite Scott Bakulas.
Yeah, one of my favorite of many Scott Bakula.
of the Scott Bakula spectrum, that was probably my favorite.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
Yeah. Sawyer's singing voice is performed by Natalie Cole, who is Nat King Cole's daughter.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They had literally done that Unforgettable pairing thing, where, like, they had taken the track from Nat King Cole and then had Natalie sing a duet with it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of weird, but still cute.
So Danny, after his weird flashback, he hops on the bus and he's going back to Kokomo, and he gets about 15 feet before he sees like everyone on the side of the road,
yeah,
but
Pudge,
and then
it looks like a bread line, actually.
Yeah,
it's like they're all waiting for soup, like those pictures from the Great Depression.
Yeah, well, 1939.
Well, I thought that's what they were directly referencing. I don't know.
That might be. I mean, yeah. This movie's kind of chock full of that.
Yeah, they do a lot of references to the 30s.
Yeah,
well, it makes sense.
I mean, it's in the 30s.
No, but I mean, like in they're very thorough with their references to the 30s, except for the Hollywoodland sign. At that time, they didn't change the Hollywood sign until, I think, a decade later or something. For those, I don't know if you're in the know, but, and I wish I had a proper date so I wouldn't sound uninformed, but no, at that point in, so the movie takes place in 1939, which is the golden year of cinema, at least in the golden age
of
Hollywood.
Right, yeah, definitely the golden era.
The sign that was above, in the Hollywood Hills, said Hollywood Land. They took the land part off, I think, in, like, the mid-40s? Something. Yeah, you remember there was that Ben Affleck movie a while ago that was called Hollywood Land. It was like the crime thing. Yeah, that was it was roughly that time, I think, is when they got rid of the land part of it, and now it's just Hollywood. Like, we've known it as Hollywood, but it was Hollywood Land for, I think, like a while.
Oh, okay.
I think it was at least 20 years. But
I should know this
anyway.
Anywho.
Well, it doesn't. How often would that come up in casual conversation?
Fair point.
Anyway. So Danny has an epiphany on the bus. He's like, I can't give up like this. I'm the plucky hero.
Yeah.
I had to get back and save everybody. So
we're just getting started.
Yeah.
I know.
The bus driver with his horrible sandwich.
So much
mayonnaise,
like watery
and cheese,
mustard.
And lettuce, and that's it. No meat, just that. So, I know it was the 30s, but come on.
And he was looking at the sandwich like, all right, if I just put a lot of lettuce and tomato, it'll be healthy.
Gotta grease.
But this tastes like gout. He slathers the whole thing, dips the vegetable.
You gotta
just
get
like dips the bread in the mustard.
Like the cheapest, like the cheapest au jus sandwich ever.
Yeah.
It just made me think of I gotta grease this down my gullet somehow. Lather on the mayo.
Like
put on some mustard.
It's like that scene in Parks and Rec when Ron's trying to eat a banana.
Oh my god.
He just ends up putting it on a burger.
He puts the banana on the punch burger.
Yeah.
Oh my god. So perfect. But no, anyway. Getting sidetracked. Anyway, so Danny sees Pudge on the side of the street, and they hatch a plan together to stage a completely unannounced musical number with Danny's friends that he met through the through the agency. So he each invites, they break into the studio.
Yeah, they like break into the studio and send
they
out
find
like...
the they find the contacts list and then add their names to it to the premiere for Little Archangel, which is Darla's movie. They all make it to Grandma's Chinese Theater. All the characters show up in the audience. Danny and Pudge are trying to organize things in the back to get ready for the musical number. Pudge inadvertently alerts Max to notifying them that they're in the back, just when he's straightening his tie, because Max is a freak, he can hear him.
Yeah, of course his, like, itty-bitty monster ears.
Yep, he's got supersonic hearing. He finds them in the back, and, chases, there's an elaborate chase sequence that involves Danny and, Max on top of the theater. Danny defeats him, but then they have to get back down and still try to make the musical number work. Once Danny convinces all of them to come back there, Darla realizes what's going on. She sneaks behind the stage and then starts sabotaging everything.
Well, she attempts to, but it's like...
But she keeps making it better.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the ones, like, she's got, like, a... She's got a giant box of light bulbs that she's chucking and, like, trying to hit them, and instead, like...
It makes a really
There's, like, a little, like, mini firework effect around them dancing or something.
I probably shouldn't talk when I'm eating. I'm sorry. Hold on.
Oh, that's fine. Probably shouldn't cough so much.
Yeah, maybe you shouldn't. Oh, look at us here in our respective places. I don't like it. Oh, my. Anyway, so the musical number goes off without a hitch, despite what Darla was
despite Darla's best intentions.
No, despite Darla's worst intentions, everything goes fine. And the entire audience is super supportive, and they love it.
And then, she somehow makes her way back on
stage. She hobbles her way back up through, I think it's the trapdoor.
Yeah, and she's got, like, she's bundled in a bunch of audio, and there's a boom mic above her.
Strapped above her head like a carrot above a donkey's head. Accidentally blabs that she had flooded the entire stage and ruined everything.
Yeah, she had, like, sabotaged this whole thing,
Yeah, she's a monster.
Yeah, she's just an awful person.
And she finally realizes that she can't get away with it anymore. Pudge pulls another trapdoor lever, and then she falls down into the bottom of the stage. And, and then the movie just ends with a really nice montage of some movie posters of a bunch of
properties
that are owned by Warner Brothers.
Which was just, like, redone with the animals. Like, my favorite is still the Casablanca one.
Yeah, the Casablanca one with Francis and, Francis and Cranston. I think I just gave them a power couple name.
Excellent.
I think my favorite is probably either the Singing in the Rain one. I thought was really cute.
Yeah, no, and, it's super cute. I love it. You know what kills me about it is just Pudge.
He's just like... Just in the middle, like Donald O'Connor.
Yeah.
And he's still got his weird, like, flat top haircut. My other favorite is probably the Beetlejuice one, too. With T.W. as Beetlejuice.
That was good.
Danny and Sawyer as Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin. Yeah.
No,
that was Alec Baldwin. It was a very young Alec
Baldwin. No, not on the... Not
no, in Beetlejuice?
Not for that character.
What? Yeah. No. In Beetlejuice, yeah.
He was in Beetlejuice, but that wasn't Alec Baldwin.
No, he was the husband in Beetlejuice. No. Yes, he was.
Well, yeah, so I was wrong.
This just in, Tracy was right. To be fair, it was a very young, very attractive Alec Baldwin.
He looks like Bill Pullman to me.
He looks like Bill Pullman. But at that point, it was young Alec Baldwin. Yeah, the only reason you can't tell is because he has a shirt on the entire time. You should find any Alec Baldwin... No, this is getting too weird.
Off topic.
It's a very fast movie. It's 75 minutes.
I mean, it's like...
That's with credits, but...
It's a tightly written movie.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, there's really only the one major conflict, and that's about it.
Yeah.
So, there's a pretty clear antagonist, hero story thing. It's fun. I think it's just, it's an interesting romp because it's such a weird story to have for children, I guess.
It's a little bit odd in that way.
Because the story seems geared more towards either people that are involved with Hollywood or that know of
Hollywood systems, like, movie buffs of the 30s. And things like that.
I feel like it was geared more towards, like, maybe their parents to an extent.
Maybe.
But
I
it,
mean,
it
like,
didn't have, like, the adult jokes that you would expect from, like, a Shrek movie or, like, any of those.
Yeah, anything produced in the last, like, 15 years or so.
Yeah, but that was the 90s.
Yeah. But, well, so, I actually, I was thinking about this the last couple times we watched it. Because we've watched it like four times this week.
When we do these reviews, we try to go through them a few times.
Yeah, because like that for, I mean, like especially with Cats Don't Dance, where I haven't seen it in many years.
But luckily it's so fast we don't even mind.
Yeah, just tear right through it. But no, I like the intro because it actually starts itself off in the same way as like any storybook movie, like, literally going, once upon a time, and then it gives you, like, princess and peasant, and it doesn't immediately reveal to you that Darla Dimple is an awful person.
Yeah.
It just says, like...
Well, she looks adorable. Everything
exactly.
in her entire environment is, like, hearts,
pinks,
and
cute,
and, like, her design makes her look like a big baby, like, like physically like a giant baby, not, like...
Yeah, there's, like,
anything. Like, she's basically just curves, like, all of her limbs are pointed, like, everything is just...
Her arms and legs are just, like, these weird oblong
she's
ovals.
She's got, like, tiny doll hands on the ends of, like, if you cut half of a baseball bat off. Like, it just, like, these weird rounded, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but, like, no, it's, when you look at her, it's,
so
like,
you haven't, like,
she looks like a stereotypical cute character, which is completely deliberate, as she's supposed to be a parody of Shirley Temple.
Right, exactly. So there's something, like, there's something to be said for the way they framed that to start with.
He says nothing. Anyway, so Darla is, her entire environment is very controlled, very cute. It's very...
Well, it's all highly manicured.
Yeah, like, it seems like it's very well maintained by... It's literally well maintained by Max, who's her servant.
Yeah.
But
the rest
of it is all just about, like, artifice. Like, it's
this
entire image, this entire persona that she has to perpetuate, or that she believes in, or that she's supposed to believe in, to keep the public on her side.
Right,
because if they knew how big
of
a monster she really is, which is what the cast sees,
right,
they would never actually go after her, or they would never support her.
Right. And we see, like, I mean, even though the character is supposed to be, like, definitely, like, 6 or 7. Like,
probably, yeah.
A small child, probably.
Shirley Temple was 5 when she was doing most of her movies.
Right, exactly. Yep. So, since the character's obviously directly referencing Shirley Temple, that's sort of what we're looking at there. But even that, she's got that weird, like, the face mask or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
That they do. They do that a couple times in the movie.
Yeah, like, they really want to make sure it doesn't seem like she's aging.
Yeah. Listen, this 7-year-old has to look like a 5-year-old.
Yeah. She uses more clay masks than I do, and I'm 26. Like, I don't know if a 5-year-old has crow's feet. If she does, I doubt that she's 5. She may very well be disguising herself in some way. I don't know.
We're looking at some, we're wandering into some weird territory there.
Looking at you, David Lynch.
I have nothing to say to that.
Never mind. That might have been a little too weird. And Danny is presented as the very stereotypical Midwestern. And we can
we're from the suburbs of Chicago.
Yeah, so we can do that. We know that he's the stereotypical Midwestern, but
corn-fed and...
Yeah, I mean, he's very innocent, he's very naive, and he's got really big dreams and stuff. Like, it's very admirable. Like, he's a sweet character. Like, he's kind. He can make friends with pretty much anybody. He's really interested, and he's very ambitious too.
He's very ambitious.
But he doesn't seem to believe on stepping on other people to do it, which
no,
is cool.
Absolutely not.
Where Darla is the antithesis of this, that's why she's been able to maintain her career. And that's why she is where she is now. She has an entire song about that.
Right, yeah. The whole, like,
about,
big
like,
and loud thing and, like...
Yeah, where
it's
she's
all
like,
about,
I didn't get where I am today by letting myself get pushed around. Where she's like, yeah, she does not screw around.
Yeah, no. It's an interesting contrast in those two characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's unfortunately, like, these characters aren't super deep, so there's not a great deal to discuss with them, with the exception of Darla, who obviously has this sort of, like...
That just sends... It seems to be a recurring trend in kids' movies.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Where it's like, well, for some reason, like, say, like, for the Disney movie, like, this is the second time we're going to reference Disney.
I feel like it's going to happen a lot.
It's going to happen. But, so, like, that's... I think that's part of the reason why Disney villains are so popular, because they... have the time to become more complex.
Yeah, there's a bit more.
It's like,
a bit more
you like
complex
the heroes, but
sometimes.
For some reason the villains just resonate with people somewhat.
In
because
some
it's time. All the stuff that we don't want to enact on, but we see other people do it.
Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, like, there's. It's sort of the same reason that some people watch Game of Thrones, if they've got, like, a complex for war or something.
I guess.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not saying I do. I'm not projecting. No. But, like, I think that there's just something about, like, villains or people that are that revel in their just being evil and the fun of being evil.
Yeah,
that's just so
that,
fun to,
like,
watch.
Yeah. Plus, as we've said a few times, like, the expressions of Darla are so great.
She has a lot of extremes.
Well, yeah, because, like, you were saying earlier, like, when it becomes, when she makes, like, ridiculous faces, she's, like, all forehead and, like, all her facial features are scrunched into, like, the bottom third of her face.
Yeah, it's called a squash and stretch is a animation technique wherein if they're doing, like, a expressive thing, like, say if somebody's surprised or freaked out or something, their face might elongate. As though,
right.
Like, say, like, if you had, like, a ball or something and you were stretching something out. It would make the features look even more exaggerated. But with Squash, which is what happens with Darla when she gets angry, her face, like her eyes, her eyebrows, mouth, nose, everything shrinks down to like a third of what her face size actually is to make her look a little bit more maniacal or creepy. Like, she almost looks like a monkey, actually.
Yeah.
She gets like oddly primate looking faces. So
yeah, she does a little bit.
But yeah, she's
hanging out with Max all the time.
Really?
I'm joking.
Oh, yeah.
Because Max is clearly a massive gorilla.
Yeah, sometimes they look the same whenever they're really angry.
Yeah.
For a second, I thought you were talking about your nephew. No.
I don't have a Max.
No, who's Max?
John's nephew.
That's right.
Cut it out! Now!
No! Button your lip before I button it for you. actually, mentioning Max... his character is a direct reference to Max, which was Norma Desmond's butler from Sunset Boulevard.
Okay.
It's a movie from the 50s. It's a film noir about this aging film actress who's completely delusional. She holds herself up in her house and rewatches these films of her when she was a bigger actress.
So it's kind of like BoJack Horseman watches his own TV show.
Yeah, but it involves murder.
Right, except it's a film noir movie, not a comedy about this.
But if you've ever heard that quote, I am big, it's the pictures that got small, that's what it's from.
Huh.
Yeah, so she's, but Max is completely devoted to her in that movie and completely fulfills this delusional figure of herself that she has. Of her still being viable and popular and not box office poison or anything. So, but his entire character design, everything is directly taken from Max, even the scar that Max has on his face.
Yeah,
he can't stop dance.
That,
yep, same deal.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I love Max.
Because he mostly just moves only one section of his body at a time.
Yeah, he's like, if you watch the movie, like, it's just one portion of him is moving and animated.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it is completely still, with the exception of the dance scene.
Yeah.
Where he actually...
That's the,
like,
one time.
Yeah, like, it's like super into it.
But even when he starts off dancing, like, he does, like, his shoulders and
hips start moving and then his shoulders and then... Soon as the whole body.
Yep. But when we're first introduced to Max,
he just appears.
He bursts through one of the studio walls.
Well, yeah, you don't even see that. You just see, like, his hole in the wall, and then, like,
it,
like, pans over to him, like, and just, like,
it would have been, like, one of those Wile E. Coyote, like, burst through a wall or something, but he's completely stoic and, like, his body...
upper body is still...
It's like if you pushed a fridge through a piece of, cardboard or something. Or no, it's like styrofoam or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, where it still maintains its shape, where it's like... He's intimidating, but he's one of my favorite characters in the movie.
He's just so much fun. He's hilarious.
When he talks,
terrifying.
When he talks, he only moves his lips. Like, he doesn't blink a single time in
the
movie.
No, yeah, we watched Mad.
We counted this time.
We were paying attention. We're like, he doesn't blink
it's
at all.
Did he in that one part? No, he didn't. He didn't at all.
He doesn't in the whole movie.
No, but But that just makes me like him more.
Yeah, it just makes him more entertaining.
He
said,
he never sleeps. Maybe he doesn't have to. Maybe he's a robot. Maybe he's a Frankenstein. Oh, that's a kitty
cat. Like, his mouth's like a zipper.
Yeah, do yourself a solid and see if you can find some animated GIFs of Max on Tumblr or something. And it's it's so, he's so much fun to watch.
Yeah, he kind of steals the show in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do you want to get into Sawyer and the supporting cast?
Yeah. So, the other, like, Sawyer, I think, is probably one of the somewhat more complex characters in this movie.
No, she gets time, at least.
She gets some time. I mean, like, obviously side characters, you know, you can't really do much.
When you've got six, or, like, five, whatever.
Yeah, well, you've got a fairly large cast crammed into 75 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and you also have to do exposition and rising and falling action, and all those, like...
It's very tight, but I remember seeing this on the Disney Channel a lot.
Yeah?
They used to rerun it when I was a kid.
Well, yeah, because they would just cram, like, a ton of commercials into it, because it would fill the running time.
It would usually be for some Kirk Cameron movie, or Kim Possible.
Yeah.
From what I remember. But yeah.
But so Sawyer's interesting because she's actually got this, like... I mean, we don't know how long any of these characters have been in Hollywood. Like, we were Tracy and I were discussing that a little bit earlier.
Yeah, it's established that they're friends, but we have no idea how long they've either been in Hollywood or how long they've known each other.
Right, yeah. Like, we get the sense that Cranston and Francis have been there a while, like, probably... Mm-hmm.
Probably since The Silence, I would think.
Yeah, probably.
Because they seem to have a lot of resentment for how the system works now. Francis makes a comment about working for scale, which is both a fish pun and,
minimum wage.
Yeah, and that maybe if she may have been a bigger actress or something at one point, and then when the studio system came into practice, then she might not have, or, like, because they're animals, they're considered minorities in the film industry.
Right, true, and, like, it's possible she just did, like... I don't know, because I was reading, I looked it up briefly, and it was like, you pay, like, being, working for scale, like, you get paid less if you don't appear, versus if you do.
Is that something like, you know, SAG, like, the Screen Actors Guild, where they have, like, a SAG minimum of what they get paid?
Maybe it's...
It might be what it is now, because SAG is a modern invention.
Yeah, definitely wouldn't have existed
back
then.
No, but...
So we don't know how long any of these characters have been in Hollywood, but Sawyer kind of, like, seems like she's been there a good stretch of time.
Mm-hmm.
And she, like we said earlier, probably was going to be, like, some sort of jazz...
Like a jazz musician
song and
or
dance.
Something.
Yeah.
It's heavily hinted that that's what she was going to be doing, like, as though she was, like, a performer, like, not like Josephine Baker, but similar in that she would be, like, a singer, dancer, actress, like Ginger Rogers.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
So that's kind of what we have going on there, and it's kind of I was thinking about this earlier. I don't know if this statement is fully fleshed out, but you can almost make the argument that Danny is like her magical pixie boyfriend,
Exactly.
Like, he's super energetic and happy, and like
I'm not going to challenge you, girl. I just want to show you the life that you used to have.
Right. Yeah. But so he pops into her life and like reminds her of what she like wanted to do, and then helps her do it, which is kind of interesting.
He's kind
of
like Patrick Swayze from Dirty Dancing, but has no, like...
Yeah,
but he doesn't have any of the aggression.
Incredibly creepy.
Yeah, he doesn't have any of the aggression that Patrick Swayze did.
Ooh.
And he's a lot less physically intimidating.
Yeah. I mean,
he's like,
the only character that's physically intimidating is Max.
And Darla, to an
extent. Yeah, I mean, Darla isn't physically intimidating. It's just like...
Well, she is
is, because she's able to, like... She clearly has the director Flanagan, like, browbeaten to, like, know your place.
Yeah, which is
really
very disturbing to see a 5-year-old child do that to a man who's presumably in his 40s.
Yeah.
Probably.
In fairness, that he's, like, a man's child.
Yeah, he is. And he has a very disturbing infatuation with LB Mammoth, who's there at the studio. They've almost got a bromance similar to Miguel and Tulio from The Road to El Dorado. It's clearly one sided on Flanagan's part.
Sequel to the Cats Don't Dance.
Oh my god.
It's just a throw comedy between those two.
That should have been one of the posters
at
the end. That would be so perfect. Could you imagine if the two of them were like they were on the back, if they were on the back of Altivo? With like LB in the foreground and then planning it. Yeah, with LB as Tulio. Oh, that would be so perfect. Oh, I want to see that happen now.
I really like that idea.
Who would be Chell? Darla?
No one wins. No one wins.
Sorry, Colonel cut my throat. I really hope that this eating isn't too distracting. If it is, I'm sorry, but you can swear under your breath when you listen to it.
I assume you already are.
Because we're not doing it on here.
Yeah, but I'm trying.
What are we talking about?
The last thing I remember is we were talking about physically intimidating characters. Yes. The only one who's physically intimidating is Max.
Wooly is kind of too.
Wooly
and Tilly are both gentle giants. Max completely uses his size for brute strength.
I mean, he like slaps Danny.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't bat an eye. He basically crushes Danny with his hand. Because you have to wonder how big Max really is.
Yeah,
do you want to tell them about the scene where she's flooding the ark?
What I'm just saying is, like, there's not a large consistency in the size of his character. In that, like, he can obviously pick up Danny, who is probably, like, 4-ish feet tall.
I'd say. I mean, if we're going by anthropomorphic, like, Darla seems roughly the size that a kid would be at that age.
Yeah.
And most of the animals measure up to, like, at least half of where Flanagan is. I would say he's probably, like, 5'7".
Yeah, he's probably not a tall man. Mm-mm. He just looks like it because he's a thin...
No, he's not a tall man. He's just wearing riding pants, which makes everyone look taller.
Well, and he's super thin, and he's like a toucan.
Yeah, he's got a parrot nose.
He does.
Yeah.
Danny's like 3 or 4 feet tall, like 4 feet-ish, and Max picks him up, and he's like, pretty much the entirety of Danny is in that hand.
Yeah. His
His head is poking out, and like maybe the ends of his feet.
Yeah, his hand like engulfs him. Like Danny looks like a Lego figure.
Yeah,
exactly. No, a Playmobil figure relative to if we were doing it.
And then he just like shoves him down.
Mm-hmm. That's really painful.
Yeah. Well, then there's the scene Tracy was mentioning, like when they're flooding the stage, he's like, "Man, the valve!" And he's this massive wheel that is gripped in his hands. And you're like, who else would use that? Yeah,
there's this gigantic water pressure valve that's on the stage. It's supposed to be used for the the sprinklers. I'm sorry. The sprinklers like, say if the fire breaks out. Max's hands are so big that they in both completely grasp the wheel on both sides, like he's turning a boat, basically.
Yeah.
But he can turn it so much that he rips the entire thing off of the valve from steam that has been bolted down.
Yeah.
Which is... it's...
I mean, like, you can only read so much into it, but...
I can only assume that they take a lot of liberties with the size of the stage.
Well, yeah.
But, I don't know. Like, this is the kind of weird stuff that we think about.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about, like...
The logistics are laughable at best.
Yeah, when you really, like, break down some things like that, like, well, what do you do about meat when, like, cows are people, too?
I didn't think about that.
It's one of those things, like, it's a kid's movie. Stop reading into it, but also,
I know,
like,
but there are so
it
few...
It bothers me!
There are so few cattle actors, too. Where are they going?
We all know where they're going.
To the freezer of your local grocer. And you're the cause of it!
War butchers.
Oh. But do you think that the cows ever try to, like... No, this is getting too gross.
Abort!
We need to have less vivid imaginations.
Yeah, we need to jump ship on this particular topic.
This is what the internet has done to us. So the other supporting characters we've got... they seem to be at the talent agency a lot.
That's probably what they got,
so familiar with each other. Makes
sense. Yeah. So there's Tilly, who is this big, like... Tracy was pointing out earlier, looks exactly like Daisy from...
Yeah, like she's got Daisy Duck's costume.
But yeah, she's super nice and friendly, and she's also a hippo.
Mm. And she's voiced by Peggy Hill.
Yes, which is delightful. Mm-hmm. And then there's
Kathy Najimy, who does the voice of Peggy Hill on King of the Hill.
Yeah. And then there's Frances, who's voiced by, what was it?
She's voiced by...
Betty Lou Gershon?
Yeah.
who was also Cruella de Vil, which is kind of the
animations, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, no, it's outstanding. Yeah.
I think this is also the last role she did before she died too.
Wasn't there was a similar person in there who did, or was that her?
Was it Sam Tam? No, you're thinking of Gene Kelly. Where he had died.
Was it the last thing he worked on?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Well, which will should we just get into that now?
Yeah,
Well,
so like obviously this film references a lot of like Golden Era Hollywood. So one of the people they consulted with when they were working on the movie was Gene Kelly, and mm-hmm. he kind of helped them with a lot of Dandy's dance scenes.
Mm-hmm. Gene Kelly, for those not in the know, was a very famous Hollywood singer, dancer in the 50s, I think, was his heyday. He was in Singin' in the Rain, An American in Paris, tons of movies back at that point.
Right.
But Singin' in the Rain is the one he's most known for, though, where he plays Donald Lockwood. They brought him on as a choreography consultant, so when they were animating the scenes that involved tap dancing, he directly cited, like, okay, they would do this dance here, or this move would work in that set for this mm-hmm. couples thing. He just helped them organize it, which I thought was a really interesting idea. Because it gave a lot of authenticity to it, too. As Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, people like that are considered the greatest dancers. The greatest tap dancers, absolutely, of all time.
Right. So that was kind of a neat, nod. And then also, mm-hmm. like, there's a nod to it specifically in the movie when Danny first arrives in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And he has his, like, opening number. He lands on the Hollywood...
Was it the Walk of Fame?
The Walk of Fame or whatever.
Where they have the cement handprints outside of
he lands on one that says Gene Kelly.
Yep, even though it's...
it didn't exist at the time. It wouldn't have existed at the time.
His wasn't added until the 50s, I think.
Right, So it wouldn't have been there in 1939.
Which is a little bit of anachronism.
What are you going to do? But, yeah, it's an anachronism.
It's an aneurysm.
It's an aneurysm.
It's
malignant.
Ooh.
So, anywho...
How about, should we get into, why this film has such an interesting legacy, and that it, in being a cult classic, I think.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, yeah, we can jump right into that. Yeah, so,
perhaps there's some kind of expanded universe for that.
Well, on the formerly very popular web fan site that we picked for some of our resources, actually drew up a bunch of comics.
There is a huge there's a huge fan site for this. In that, like, it's got a big collection. I think it still has the cult status that we would assume for most movies.
Yeah, kinda.
Like, we tend to go after certain movies like this wherein, like, they're a little bit, like, they're not quite as mainstream as you would think. And I want that to come off in the least hipster way possible.
But, yeah, I think we just, but, like, I don't know, like, I
well,
like
animation. This particular film, it was, we also like obscure animation, which is why we did this, but... But this movie in particular is weird in that it was the only feature that was released by Turner Feature Animation.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is, like, sort of an unfortunate confluence of circumstances. So, like, it came out in 1997, like, mm-hmm. right around the time of Hercules. So you had you had to contend with a big Disney movie
with that in the box office that was very well marketed.
Yes, and they
do this movie
which was poorly marketed, and also this was during the
it was a circumstance of there was a merger that was going on at the time where Warner was being Time Warner was buying out Turner, I think the like Ted Turner's animation company or something like they were merging at the time. It was the 90s; it happened. Corporations were getting bought up like crazy.
So it what it produced for them was, like, they pretty much had, like, a new boss every week kind of mm-hmm. thing. And I guess one of the things they talked about is, like, as a result of having a different boss every week throughout the production process, there would be, like, someone else telling them, like, we want this kind of movie. And they're like, we can't do that now.
They basically kept shopping them notes, like, every couple of weeks where it's like, oh, should you change this now? It's like, we can't do that. This movie is 90% done.
Yeah, we literally can't do that.
It's ready to be launched. Like, we need to start shipping out copies immediately.
Yeah, we need to start advertising this. Yeah. And so because of the merger and all this, it didn't really get the advertising it deserved. And
it got almost minimal. Completely minimal.
Right, so, like, lack of advertising was kind of weird for me when I was a kid, because I remember watching a bunch of, like, VHSs and stuff I had.
Yeah.
Where there were ads for it, and I was like, I really want to see that.
I remember seeing it on the Anastasia VHS, because I wore that VHS out. I watched it so many times with Bridget, who's my, she's my friend. I just remember seeing ads for it, and I'm like, oh, that looks really fun, but it doesn't really show you that much, like, It's, like, the advertisement itself, I think, couldn't have been more than 30 seconds, probably.
Yeah, it was a short, and it was
Yeah,
short.
It was, which is, it's a shame, because it doesn't really give you the atmosphere of what the movie is.
Yeah, well, but, I mean, yeah. Yeah, it was...
But now trailers give almost the entire story away.
Yeah, there's sort of that
So
trick
I would almost
where...
take that back.
Yeah, it's sort of that trick where you have to find a trailer that creates mystery like, of wanting to see it, but also... Yeah.
Some kind of happy medium, I guess.
Yeah. It
exists. There have been a couple of trailers that do that pretty well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, so it's really unfortunate, because, like, we were looking at it earlier, and, mm-hmm. Like, the movie was made on a budget of, what, like, $30
million? I think it was 32.
Yeah.
Something like
That's
that.
Right.
Yeah,
it was, like, 32, and it drew in, like, just...
It was 3.5.
Yeah, just over a tenth of its budget.
I think that was the direct domestic gross for the film when it came out was $3.5 million. So to only get a tenth of your budget back is pretty abysmal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the studio folded immediately after that.
And that's why it's their only movie.
Yep, the only one they ever made. They had some toys released through Subway Kids Meals, and there were two books. There was a junior novelization and a picture book. That's it.
Right.
No other material or no other promotional stuff, merchandise, anything else was made.
Yeah, which seems counterintuitive. Like you could easily make plushes.
Because
of
there's so many characters that
anything.
You can make money with.
I mean, they're all animals. You could make plushes of any of them.
You
like,
don't have to pay royalties. It practically writes itself.
I mean, come on, how cute would a plush Pudge be though?
I know. I would love a plush Pudge or a
Ooh,
Danny
sailor
or,
outfit.
No, Soiler. Soiler. Soiler.
Sounds like a bad Pokemon.
Siler. Could you imagine how bad it would be to have a Siler plush? Sawyer dressed as Siler? No. It's a real shame because I think this movie's pretty underrated. It's got a pretty decent cult following though.
Yeah,
so
yeah. If you look up the if you like Google it, one of the first things come up is the fan site, which
It's
truthfully
super
is,
comprehensive.
Yeah, it's got like a whole bunch of like character like
development
art.
They've got model sheets, they've got fan art, they've got fan fictions, they've got screen caps, tons of stuff.
Yeah,
they even have an original mirror of the first Cat Stone Dance website,
yeah,
the one that they released back in the mid-90s.
Right, yeah,
so,
it actually has some very
cool.
interesting like production notes and stuff.
Yeah, and there's some great interviews with some of the staff that worked on it too, including Lauren Faust, who ended up creating My Little Pony and Super Best Friends Forever. She was one of the character animators for Sawyer,
right?
Which is pretty impressive.
And it kind of shows like the style of
mm-hmm.
Sawyer.
Like,
in some
scenes, it's soft, like big
and
eyes
and
everything. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, super cute.
She's got a type.
Yeah.
It's a real shame that this movie didn't do a little bit better.
Yeah, it really is kind of frustrating because I think.
Let's talk about the legacy of the director, Mark Dindal. Yeah.
Right, so Mark Dindal was the director, and he, he directed the movie, but he also provided the voice for Max, which is kind of another result of that whole merger thing, was they planned on doing... Mm-hmm.
They were going to have an actor come in.
Yeah, they're going to have someone actually come in, but he did, like, a scratch track that he just, I guess, just to have something so they knew what he would sound like,
mm-hmm.
and then that just ended up being his voice, because they never had the money for it or something like...
Like, to me, I think it worked a lot better.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. Well,
just,
I
like,
love...
Knowing that I like those, like, when directors sneak themselves into
yeah,
movies.
Yeah, I love it,
Mel Brooks is the most egregious person that does this, but he's such a ham, you love him.
Yeah, he's
so
really, I mean, he's really
completely
good at what he
does,
so... But yeah, I love that in animated movies when you have the director has just, like, a bit part, right?
Yep. It for some reason, when I was hearing Max's voice, I got a couple of flashbacks to the Iron Giant when Vin Diesel was doing the voice of the Iron Giant.
I didn't see that.
When you watch the special features on the Iron Giant DVD, it's just astonishing watching Vin Diesel record. He's just like this huge, gigantic man. Like
he also he did that for Groot too.
Yeah, same
deal. And he recorded in every language.
Yep. Wait, just say Yo Soy Groot.
Pretty much.
Ich bin Groot.
I assume. That's... Yeah, pretty much so. He did all the dubbing for it, so it was in his voice.
Ich heiße Groot. Yeah, I only know German and Spanish.
Yeah.
Barely.
Yep.
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 Yep. You went to college for it, though.
Yeah,
yeah.
Spanish in college.
Yeah. Yeah,
and yet here I am, speaking almost no Spanish.
Not for long. But no, it's a fun movie. Oh, by the way, Mark Dindal, who also went on to do one of our favorite movies.
Right,
yes.
He did The Emperor's New Groove.
Yes.
Which, if you watch those two movies, like, kind of, like, in sync.
Makes so much sense.
playing them back to back. You're like, yeah, all right.
All the zaniness of the animation comes to play. Like, a lot of the humor is very similar.
Yeah, yeah, there's a very good, similar type of humor.
They have a lot of really exaggerated faces and sight gags and stuff that work.
Yeah, some of those sight gags.
They're perfect.
And Cats Don't Dance are great.
Yep. The one at Darla's.
Where Max is. Like, they walk away, and they pan to the, door, and suddenly Max is right there.
And Danny's holding Danny's hat, and then, like, Danny does a double take, like, how did he get there so fast? Like, I remember really loving that, so.
Yeah, it's a really good joke.
Yeah, it's a real shame, because I think the movie would have done substantially better if the studio, the movie would have done substantially better if the studio had bothered to market
it. Yeah, if there had been some actual hype for the movie.
Yeah, and Mark Dindal, the director, had blamed them for it. I mean, which is completely warranted. I would be livid if that was the case, where it's like, this is my baby that we worked on for 4 years, and you're not even going to give it, like, a couple of
shows.
Did they
work, like, for 4 years on it?
Oh, most animated films like that, yeah. Okay. Well, no, this one had actually been, that's another interesting trivia thing. The idea behind this movie was it had been shopped around since 1993. Originally, it was intended as a vehicle for Michael Jackson.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was the first idea for it was that. But I think it just went through, like, the creative process of, like, development.
Yeah. Well, there were, forever. There were four writers listed in the credits, so I mean, like...
Yeah, and a weird thing is that once most of the animation had been done, the original actress that they had for Sawyer, I think her name is Nancy Giles, I forget.
Yeah, something like that. She's dropped out of the film.
She had originally done Sawyer's voice, and she had a much huskier, like, deeper, raspy voice.
Yeah, something that fit a little bit more with...
With her singing voice.
Yeah, with Natalie Cole.
Yeah, because if you hear Jasmine Guy's voice in the film, it's a perfectly fine Sawyer voice, but a very weird juxtaposition to hear her go from talking to singing immediately.
Yeah, because it goes from this, like...
It's really incongruous. Like, it's just like, oh, like, all right.
Where's that coming from?
It's kind of like if you've ever seen Quest for Camelot with Garrett, the blind hermit, and he was voiced by Cary Elwes, and then his singing voice is Bryan Adams.
Oof.
It's just so weird.
Yeah, it's one of those disconcerting.
He goes from being a British man to a weird Canadian rock star in, like, 3 seconds. But, So if you really like Art Deco, if you really like talking animals, if you really like movies from the 30s, musicals, dancing, singing and dancing animals, Shirley Temple's Gone Psychotic... You should really check out
Giant
Cats
Gorillas
Don't Dance.
Who move in one giant, enormous, terrifying step at a time.
Giant gorillas that love to salsa and mambo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He was 20 years shy of being able to do the swim. Do you know how hilarious that would have been?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. If he was doing the monkey, I want to make like a two frame gif of just Max doing the monkey, just having his arms go up and down and the rest of it.
Yeah,
completely
nothing else
stoic.
Moves. Yeah, that's how it works.
Yep.
That'd be really funny.
I would love that. Or I want him to be holding maracas when he does it too. Like Samba de Amigo, but horrifying. It's a fun game.
It's a good gag.
It's a good one.
Yep. All right. There's some other stuff going on in this film that we just, unfortunately, we didn't really get to, but...
It's not a ton. I mean, like, it's a pretty straightforward film.
Yeah, yeah,
are there any real things that parents should, like, worry about or, like, look out for?
Darla's
a pretty abysmal role model, I'll say that much, but she's not framed as though she's supposed to be the one you're rooting
for. I mean,
if
you have a thing for Clark Gable, you might be slightly offended. It's hilarious.
I wasn't at all.
His hilarious caricature, which I adore.
Yeah, which I thought was great. He kind of looks like he's got two pancakes on the side of his head. He's got, like, just, like, ugh. Like, there's a lot of really great caricatures of stars from, like, the 1930s.
Right,
40s.
Yeah, from that time.
And there's, like, Joan Crawford, Cary Grant, W.C. Fields, Mae West, Laurel and Hardy. They're all in there.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. So that's sort of just some nice fun
they
had in the movie.
It's pretty... Yeah, it's an interesting film. It's a strange little anomaly that this is the one that got made by Turner. But
yeah,
so glad that it did.
Yeah, I'm glad this is the movie that came out, not something.
But I like that they did something fairly ambitious and very interesting.
Yeah,
like,
it
plays like a Saturday morning cartoon, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, it's very, like, quick and it resolves nicely.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of unique in that way, but.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's unique in general.
Yeah.
But it's really good. If you, for some reason, haven't seen it in the last 12 years... No.
No.
Damn it.
Wait.
Not 20 yet.
How old are 18 we?
18 years.
Nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
That is horrifying.
Yeah, right? I remember
so
being
freaky.
A kid when this movie was
yeah.
coming out.
I remember just Ooh. Eagerly just being like, Mom, can we go see that? I was like 8 or whatever, like coming out of Hercules, and they're just like, no.
That's it.
I think I remember later getting it from the library, which I loved.
Yeah. And, but so yeah, for some reason you haven't seen this in the last almost 20 yeah. years. On that.
I mean, I can guarantee that you should be able to find a copy of it for pretty cheap.
Absolutely.
Actually, sometimes you see it bundled with Quest for Camelot.
Yeah, that's it exists, but yeah. you can find it by itself, but yeah. it also is bundled with Quest
yeah.
for Camelot.
I've seen it at like Target, Amazon, Walmart, even.
Yeah, the $5
have it. I mean, well, yeah, I mean, like it's like five. I mean, it's $5. You really can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Or if you are one of the. If you're one of the few people that still has a video store nearby you, you will probably still find it, too. There's one pretty close to us that still carries it.
Yeah.
So, and we can rent kids' movies for free.
Yep.
And no, it's not because they like us. It's because they assume
it's their policy
that we need to entertain children for free, which I partially agree with.
I'm not willing to pay
Guess
money.
Which part I agree with.
Free?
Yes. Yes, that part.
It's the free part.
Tried to throw you for a loop. It didn't work. Forget it.
No. All right.
Yeah.
So that's it for us. Thanks again for thanks for listening again.
Yeah.
For the first time.
Yeah, if you have any ideas of movies that you want us to watch, we don't really know how many of you listen to this all the way through.
Yeah.
But if you think of something that you want us to watch, you can just respond with a hashtag animation station. I'm gonna try to get a graphic or something.
You can also comment on the episodes.
Yeah, that too.
But absolutely.
Same deal. We'll still see it.
Yeah, just let us know if there's anything in particular you'd like us to take a look at. Obviously, we try to stick to things that are a little lesser known.
Yeah.
So
if there's something I don't know. I've never seen Last Unicorn. I'd be willing to watch that.
Yeah, sure.
I'd like to watch that. I would like to watch American Pop, which is one that I told Robbie about. I don't think he's seen it. It's a Ralph Bakshi film. That's very... It's rotoscoped, so you have to be okay with rotoscoping. Which, I know, it's a little bit janky. Like, it seems a little bit weird, but it's a very good film. And it's all about, American pop music from, the 30s onward.
Okay,
Until, the mid-70s. It's such a good story, though.
Things you may see from us in the future. So.
Yeah. There's a couple of things we've been shopping around. We don't know what we're going to do next as of right now.
But... Yeah, well, the next week's going to be sort of tricky. Out of town, so...
And I've got this next weekend's going to be pretty busy for me, too.
Yeah, so I'm not sure... So the next episode may be delayed or may not happen next week.
Yeah, or if we decide on something, then maybe I can release it when you're gone or something.
Yeah,
so, whatever.
We'll figure
it
out.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you again. Bye, everybody.